Hey everyone, how are you? Welcome to this week's episode of our podcast. It's called Is Breakfast Included? Thanks for checking us out and thanks for stopping in once again. On the show this week, we have a bona fide legend in the music industry, Mr. Jake Berry. Jake talks about how a chance meeting with Rick Wakeman got him into this crazy business, tells a few stories, talks about a few of the bands he's production managed. You might have heard of them. It was a great time talking with Jake and was an honor working with him on this thing here in Las Vegas at the Sphere. They don't come any cooler than Jake Berry, and you'll understand why once we get into this conversation. It was a lot of fun. Let's check it out. Tell everyone who you are.
Yes, my name is Jake Berry, and at the minute, I'm the production director for U2 at the Sphere in Las Vegas.
Where are you from?
I'm originally out of England, the south of England, a place called, nobody will ever hear of it, Dunkeswell, which is in the county of Devon.
Okay, I know where Devon is.
Yeah, there you go, then we're winning.
I have friends in Devon.
Okay.
Growing up, what were you a musician? How did you get into this business? Is this something you fell into by accident?
Well, I used to play drums when I was 15, 16, or 17 around that area in local village halls, you know, playing cover tunes. Not very good. And then I had a big decision to make when I was 18, whether I was going to invest in a new drum kit or a car. So I chose the car. So that became the end of my playing career. And as for getting into this business, really by luck, being at the right place, right time, like a lot of us, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a well-documented story, so I'll try not to make the biblical version. I'll try to abridge it a little bit. I have a twin brother. My brother is what's called a Thatcher. And for those of you listening to this in England, you know what a Thatcher is. For those of you living in the rest of the world, it's the guy that puts straw wheat on roofs, like an Anne Hathaway cottage in England.
Okay.
And he had done a cottage for a guy named Dave Cousins, who is in a band called the Straubs. And Dave was very good friends with Rick Wakeman, who'd played keyboards in the Straubs, and then was out on his own. And Rick had bought a farm, a farmhouse in Devon, and it had a thatch roof, and Dave recommended Rick that my brother thatch the roof for him, so which my brother did. And I was driving a truck, and I was delivering animal feed, really nothing exciting. So if you were lucky, you would get the first pickup of the day, which would be 5 a.m., and then you could be done at 11.
Yeah.
And then so you go home, and you shower, and as it's like, you know, life in villages in England, you know, because the place I came from only had 300 people at that stage. It had a church, a shop, a gas station, and a pub. So life revolved around the pub. So I was getting ready to go down for my daily or frequent afternoon couple of pints, you know, at lunchtime. And my brother called up the house, and my mother told me that he'd forgotten something at work and did I mind driving it down. So I said, I know. And I knew who Rick was, so it was quite intriguing to me.
Yeah.
You know? So I get down and Rick's there. And it was about lunchtime, like 1 o'clock, something like that. And he goes, I'm off down the pub. I can't take your brother. Do you want to come with me? So never one to turn down a free drink. I go, I'm here.
Yeah.
And then we went to the pub, and back in those days, English pubs shut at 2:30. Well, at 8 o'clock at night, we were still there because the guy had locked the door behind us. They called it a lock-in. And I got completely hammered. I think driving home with one eye was not an option because I was seeing double out of the one eye. So I got home and then I missed work the next day. I didn't get along with a guy that owned a company, so he fired me. And then, you know, it wasn't a bad thing. I didn't like to be out of work, but I was kind of happy to be away from it. And then the next day, Rick goes, I'm doing the show, The Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. And it was on ice, and it was Wembley Arena. So he offered my brother Trevor, and I said, do you want to come up and help out? And I go, what doing? He goes, you know, I'll get you a hotel room, and you can just hang out, and the road crew will tell you what to do. So we did that, and we pushed a few boxes, and we got in the way, and, you know, we did all the dirty work, and, like, you know, because it was in the round, it was a hard job to go to the bathroom. So at the end of the night, you couldn't put a porter john up there because it was too high. So there was usually a bucket with pee in it. So, you know, the good old road crew, like we do, oh, you guys, take this bucket and empty it. You know, so we did that. And at the end of the night, Rick came up and he goes, hey, yeah, do you want to go to America? So I went, I said, of course I don't. No, I'm joking. And I said, yeah. And I went off with him and the English Rock Ensemble and we toured America. And I was doing drums and percussion. And that was my first job. And that was in 1975. Yeah, so my brother Thatch and Roos got me into the business.
Oh.
Nothing to do with my useless playing earlier, you know? So, but
how old were you?
Oh, God. So that was 75. So what are we? So that was 49 years ago. And I'm 70. So 21, 22?
Yeah, I was five.
There you go. There's a lot of people that weren't born when I work with now, you know?
Yeah. What did your parents think of you just leaving and doing that? Did they think
you know, it's like all of us, you know, they say, you know, you can do this, then you need to get a real job. I'm sure everybody listening to their parents at one time, when you say you're going off to join the circus, you're in like the rock and roll industry. Well, you know, you should get a real job, but you know.
At some point.
Yeah, you get that once. So I went off and I came back and, you know, because I'm from a small village, when I came back, I'd been on tour in America and I'd been with Rick Wakeman. And so I became a bit of a local, not celebrity, but the press would come and give me, you know, do interviews and would carry on later when I would return until, you know, the place I'd grown started, you know, putting more development and it became less of a, you know, the small country village, more into a larger, you know, subdivision of a bigger town or something, you know?
Did you stay with Rick for a while?
I stayed with Rick all the way through to 1979. And he paid us full salary, you know, so we were always on. And Rick had they called it Complex 7. And it was a warehouse out in High Wycombe, which is about 40 miles from London, and we lived there. And he had a rehearsal studio. He had a flight case company. And then he had a department. He was developing a thing called the Birotron, which was, for those of you old enough to remember a Mellotron, it was the competitor to the Mellotron. The Mellotron was, the first of the keyboards where you get an orchestrated sound on through tape.
Yeah.
But you press down the keys and it only lasted like 11 seconds. The Birotron was done at this new technology back then, which was an 8-track cassette, you know? Which means you could loop it and leave it on indefinite. And, you know, didn't quite take off, but we'd work there. And then if we weren't doing, we'd work in a flight case company and we would do rehearsals if we did rehearsals. And we look after the rehearsal studio. Looking back, the rehearsal studio room was fantastic. What we'd give for something like that today.
I know, right?
Yeah. So that, and then 79, I had a close personal friend, Ian Jeffrey, who was doing monitors for Rick. And he goes, he then went off and got a job with a little known Australian rock band called AC/DC, right? So we all used to drink in the same pub. And I know the guys in AC/DC since, you know, 75, 76, because we were all in that same little pub circle.
Yeah.
You could go to our pub and pick up a road crew. You nearly pick up a band, actually, if you drank with the right people. But, you know, that's the way it was. You know, everything in England then evolved around pub life.
Yeah.
So it helped to be a consumer of alcohol in those days, you know.
That's where everything happened.
Yeah. And then Ian said to me, he goes, you know, I'm working for AC/DC. They're looking for a production manager. And I go, oh, and how does that, what's that to do with me? He goes, well, I told him that you would be a good guy for the job because you'd been a stage manager on Yes. I mean, had I been a stage manager on Yes? No. I said, okay, let's go for it. So I went, you know, and as you go through your career, you've always had people that help you along your career. And then I met the first guy that really helped me was the then AC/DC manager, Peter Mensch.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of, I said, basically, we know the truth. We lied our way in, you know? And he goes, okay, I'll give you a try. And he flew me to, they said, you'll fly to Oakland And then I'll have this guy, a legend back then called Joe Baptista, a production manager for Aerosmith and well respected. And as Peter came out of the Lieber and Krebs organization that managed Aerosmith and AC/DC, he brought Joe along, and Joe was going to be my grade master. He was going to say whether I'm going to make it or not. So we went through lessons, and the first gig was at the Oakland Auditorium, which is probably now the Bill Graham Auditorium.
Yeah.
And so after 4 or 5 days there, I sat with Joe, you know, because back then, you know, you didn't email somebody what you were doing. You didn't text somebody to see what you did, and you didn't page anybody or fax, because that didn't exist. You know, we were dinosaurs. Then you did everything on a payphone with a credit card, phone card, if anybody can remember what a payphone or even a phone credit card was. And so Joe was there, and I listened to him, how he advanced a show, and you wrote everything. He had an advance sheet, which he gave me, like, you know, how many loading docks back in those days. It was nearly a non-existing question because very few venues had loading docks. You know, what was the lights? What was the union? What was the power? All them things you need to do a show. So I listened to him, and he goes, okay, I'll listen to you now. So, you know, we got over the phone. We called up the office of a promoter. And I'd like to remember who it was, but I certainly can't now for sure. But I called up and did my first advance, and then we did our first show, and he showed me how all the, you know, the start of the union rules and things like that. And at the end, he finished. I went to the office. He goes, I'm leaving tomorrow. You got this. And back in those days, I don't know if you ever carried them, but you had a Halliburton, and it was either gold or a silver Halliburton. And that was your status. And Joe carried a silver Halliburton. I never knew what was in it. So at the end of the night, he goes, okay, you do it. I'm leaving tomorrow. I opened it, and took up most of the space with a bottle of Johnny Walker. So I didn't drink that because I'm having a drink, I'm off home. And that's where I got my first production manager gig. And it was AC/DC, and it would have been Highway to Hell.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That was Bond's last tour.
But it was Bond's last gig, you know?
And did you kind of take to the gig, like, or did, I'm sure you had stumbles along the way, but what was it like coming into this? Working with a band of that, you know?
Yes, we had stumbles on the way. Did I like it? When after the first week, I kind of decided if I could make my career this is what I'd like to do. But even if I felt then, if I had one chance, at least I got to do something that nobody else had to do, you know?
Somewhere. Yeah.
So I went in pretty determined to make it work. And it worked. Peter, like, you know, Peter mentioned, you know, that's it. He was happy. The band were happy. And, you know, they were right on the cusp of making it.
Yeah.
You know, Highway to Hell was their breaking album. And then, you know, they went away. And I worked for them full time, actually, as well. We were on retainer, so he didn't work at other things. And then, of course, then Bond, you know, died so unexpectedly, which really put a little bit of the spanner in the works for AC/DC, because I think there was a part of them that really didn't know if they wanted to carry on.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was so much energy to come from that band. And so they decided to carry on. And, you know, I've always told people that probably one of the worst jobs I've ever had in my business, I packed Bond's clothes up. I packed his apartment up and sent it home to his parents.
Oh, wow.
So I'll remember that. It was pretty emotional, but, you know, you've got to do what you've got to do, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, then they started AC/DC. We're going to carry on. We're going to audition for singers. And so that process started, and a lot of names came up. I mean, one of the names that came up was Noddy Holder. I know the singer for Slade.
Yeah.
Because they thought they would fit the mode because of his voice. But it was deemed that Noddy would always be the singer from Slade and not. It always keep be compared. So they didn't like that. And a few other people came down. Some were good. Some were awful. And then one day somebody told him they should listen to this guy, Brian Johnson. So Brian came down, did a rehearsal, and it was really good.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was getting to the point where the tour was looming. There was no singer in place. And they called back a couple of people for the, you know, the second visit, you know, they wheeled it down. And Brian came in and delivered again. And at the end of that session, you know, of course, we all went to the pub, you know, because we had to do business.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there, and it was either Angus or Mao, and one said to the other, "Are you going to tell him or shall I?" And they go, "Oh, you tell him." And one of them turned around, "Hey, Brian," because they're a bit like, you know, very short and straight to the point. "Brian, you want to be the singer for AC/DC?" He goes, "Yes." That was it. That was it. It wasn't like, "Hey, man, it was great." And then at the end of it, Brian went home, and Brian was a struggling musician then. I know I lent him £10 for gas in his car to get home. So Brian joined AC/DC, and off we went again. And what became Back in Black, and like the start of everything,
yeah,
you know, for them.
Yeah. Did he ever pay you back the £10?
No, he didn't.
So we should have a talk with him soon.
We should definitely have a conversation. And it's very ironic here. We're talking about this, my beginnings. And, you know, they're about to hit the road again. So that's where it started. And I was AC/DC a long time, and it was great. I mean, fantastic. I owe everything to Rick Wakeman and AC/DC and Peter Mensch.
Yeah. Did you think back then they'd still be starting a tour in 2024?
Ooh, I didn't even know if I'd be around in 2024, you know? So I think, you know, we lived the day, and you know, it was the 70s, late 70s, early 80s. And, you know, then we went out and AC/DC did Back in Black. And, you know, we all know Back in Black was like one of, you know, the classic rock album of all times.
Yeah,
you
massive, know? Yeah.
And we toured it. And I remember, you know, we were touring and we were in like West Virginia, and it went to number one in all the European countries and across the world. And the ironic part about Back in Black, I don't think it ever hit number one in America.
Really?
Yeah, I think I'll have to check that, but I'm quite convinced that because it was held off by Foreigner 4. So, but you know, it hovered there, and you know, it's became, I mean, that point, Back in Black, you know, all the old catalog come in. I think they had like three albums in the top 20, you know, Dirty Deeds, Power, you know, all them albums came, everybody started listening to AC/DC.
Yeah, they went back after,
it,
yeah.
It was a great time, a great, great time. I mean, it was a great time for music, the creativity.
Yeah.
It came out in the early 80s, and with the band still around, like AC/DC, you know, like Motorhead, Iron Maiden out of the English, you know,
yeah,
syndrome, and, the, you know, bands like Aerosmith out of here and things like that, you know.
Yeah. Have you ever worked with Aerosmith?
No.
Okay. Once you did the AC/DC thing, one thing I've noticed about you, and it's a trend with roadies of you know, is you're not, I've never seen you too cool to get excited. Like back then, were you just like, did you have to contain your excitement, like of what you were doing? Did you know how monumental it was at the time?
Yes, I mean, I was living in dreamland. I'm a working class guy from a village in Devon with 300 people, and I'm out touring the world, you know, with, you know, the greatest rock band in the world, one of the greatest rock bands in the world.
Yeah,
and at that time, and you know, the world was our oyster, and we were doing the Black Album, and I mean, every date was a sellout. You know, it was a special time.
Yeah. And you realized it.
I realized that I really liked what I was doing.
Yeah.
I didn't really know where it would lead to. And, you know, in our business, you know, we're in the business of entertainment.
Yeah.
And at the end of the night, and you know this as well as anybody, if somebody goes, "How was the gig last night?" And you go, if you look at it and the fans are really enjoying it, that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Not whether how great the band were that night, how, you know,
yeah,
it's how the people, that's what we do. We're there, the band are there to entertain people. We're there to make sure the band can do their job to entertain it. So every night, a little piece of the success is down to the people that put it together.
Yeah. And if you, us as a crew, we see the crowd, we know, you know.
Well, what they're doing. And it gives you energy. I mean, you walked in and say the crowd was great last night.
Yep, it was.
The first thing you say.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Moving on from AC/DC, I mean, you've production managed some of the biggest bands, you know, Rolling Stones, Black Sabbath, who's my favorite band, by the way.
All right.
You know, what was it like working with them?
I came in like when they did the album 13, which was in 2013, later. And I'd worked with Ozzy on his solo project, Bark the Moon, in 84.
Okay.
Because AC/DC, and then in the 80s, because all these, I was like the heavy metal guy. I did AC/DC tours. I mean, I made a decision that I would go freelance.
Yeah.
Because my feeling behind that was, you're only as good as your last gig. And if you were good enough, somebody else would hire. And if you're terrible, you'd be looking for work.
Yeah.
So that was maintained. I did like AC/DC. I did Ozzy. I did Metallica and Motley Crue through the 80s into the 90s. And that's what I did. And a couple of bands that I really liked and joined was like Frankie Goes to Hollywood and things like that, which was a good time. And then, you know, but going on to Sabbath after I worked with Ozzy. And so Sharon, Ozzy, and I had always, we were close. We would run into each other and it was always great, you know. So when they were going out, my friend Opie, he couldn't do it and he recommended me. So I went to LA and spoke to Sharon. Oh, you can do it, Jake. So then I went to work with Black Sabbath, and it was, you know, when you meet bands who are like your heroes,
you
always kind of wonder what they're like.
Yeah.
And a nicer bunch of guys you couldn't wish to meet. It was an absolute pleasure. Really? I had a great time, great fun. They were good people. I mean, and you know, they're the pioneers of where a lot of bands are today.
Exactly.
And I don't know if we knew it at the time, just exactly what Paranoid and them songs would mean to everybody, you know, in the 20th century.
Yeah, they're still around. I think a lot of bands like that, AC/DC, Black Sabbath, they wrote these songs. They were so organic. They were so real that they're timeless. Like, there's a lot of bands right now that are writing music like that. But I think a lot of the music right now is not going to be remembered in 40 years the way
these songs. Well, I mean, look, I'm old school, so I totally agree with you. I'm sure some of the younger bands and the people that are successful now would disagree.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that some of us live. We like to live in the past.
Yeah.
I like to live in the past purely because I thought the 80s were some of the most creative times in music that we'd ever had. And I was in the hard rock, heavy metal circuit, you know? So, you know, used to bum around in a car stop at the truck stops. And then all your crews would meet. You know, we'd bump into the guys who just finished a Motorhead gig, and then we'd bump into Iron Maiden crew. And there was always a great friendly rivalry that we'd have more lights, more sound, and load out faster. But it was just, that's the way it was. It wasn't competitive. It was just, you know, you just wanted to beat your friends.
Yeah, yeah.
But so, yeah, in the 80s was that. And then the 90s, I finished up winning Metallica on the Black Album, which was, I think for me, I think I spent 4 birthdays on that tour, I think.
Yeah.
Something like that. I started a young kid and came out an older man. And then the next biggest phase in my career was then I got a call from, you know, the next mentor in line was Michael Cole. And Michael Cole was the producer of the Rolling Stones. And he said, we're looking for a new production manager, and you're in the running. And I go, well, first of all, I'm going, fucking wow.
Yeah.
You know, look, I'm in the short list to go and work for the Rolling Stones. And, you know, go, you know, if I don't get the job, at least I know that was up there.
Yeah.
That's what I thought then, which now I know is complete bullshit, because I know if I hadn't got the job, I'd be hugely disappointed, you know? So he goes, yeah, so we're going to replace the production manager, and you're in, and we want you to go and meet Mick and meet the band. So I remember going to LA and sitting in a room, and my first meeting was with Mick. And I always remember that I was looking out the window and the door opened, and you sensed a presence. You know, you sensed that something great was happening.
Yeah.
And something special was going on. And I looked around and there's Mick Jagger. And, you know, and in your wildest dreams, did you ever think that you would be talking to Mick Jagger? And I remember looking up and I could see this. I imagined there was this aura around him, you know? And so he, you know, asked me some questions, told me what he wanted. And it was very quick, 5-10 minutes. And, you know, and in the end, I think the first bit of encouragement goes, well, we look forward to working with you. And, you know, I said, well, this is great. And then Michael goes, well, don't get your hopes up. We're going to meet Keith now. So I went to the Sunset Marquee, and Keith was there, and he was in his cabana suite. And Keith loved to play snooker. And when he couldn't play snooker, he played pool.
Uh-huh.
So I go in there, he's playing pool, and he's playing pool with John McEnroe and Vitas Gerulaitis, right? And I'm going, you know, I go, what's happening to me? So he goes, oh, you're here about the gig, right? I go, yeah. He said, you're going to be the production manager. I said, well, you know, yeah. He said, well, I'm playing pool, so talk to me while I'm playing. So I was walking around. He goes, oh, and who have you worked for? I goes, well, I said, I just finished the AC/DC tour, and he stopped. He goes, you work for AC/DC? I go, yeah. He goes, Malcolm and Angus, they're my favorites. If you work for them, that's good enough for me. So that was my Keith Richards interview, which was fantastic. And Charlie was, so, you know, as long as you can make us happy, we're good, you know? So that's how I became involved in the Rolling Stones.
Wow. Wow. It's, you know, when you say that, like, you know, you always, you're glad to be in the running, but now you know you'd have been disappointed if you didn't get it. I think about that. I think about your phone call to me.
Yeah, come here for a week.
Yeah. And it was one of those things that I kept it cool on the phone, and then I hung up. But, you know, you don't say no to a gig like this. And even if it was just for a week, you know, like,
yeah,
the fact that I thought, well, if they don't need me, then I'm happy they called. But,
and here you go, what, 7 months later?
Yeah. 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 Longest week of my life.
Yeah.
But it is. You walk
a day
in,
a month.
You walk
a month
in, and this band that you've admired for so long, like, they're there, and I see the aura. I know what you're talking about. And then, you know.
Yeah, but I mean,
when they talk to you, they talk to you like a human, and it's like, wow, I'm just me, and I'm talking to this person that I've looked up to for a long time.
Yeah, so, you know, and the Rolling Stones, that led into you too, actually.
Did it?
Yeah, because the then manager of U2, Paul McGuinness, who probably is the next in line of the Michael Coles, the Peter Metz, Michael Coles, and that, you know, Paul McGuinness was the next thing, but it stemmed from Michael Cole. We were playing, and I remember we were playing a gig in Cologne, Germany, Rolling Stones, and the band had this lounge where everybody hung up, and you get the call, Jake, can you go to lounge? Michael wants to see you. Well, Michael wants to see you in case there's something wrong or he's got a mad scatterbrain idea.
Yeah.
But he said, oh, Jake, come here, I want you to meet Paul McGuinness. He's the manager for you too. And Paul was always a gentleman.
Yeah.
Always a gentleman. And he has a nice demeanor about him, you know. And he goes, oh, Jake, you know, we might hear, you know, we could be looking for a production manager for you too. Would you be interested? And of course, like we've all learned, you never say no the first time.
Yeah.
You know, if they go, yeah, and it all comes together, you try to figure out what you're going to do. I said, of course I would. But the time has never worked. And
yeah,
for all the 90s, and then when it came to 2001, I was free, and you two were then, they wanted me to come in and help out, because I don't know why. I'd got a quite a good name for being efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they wanted to try to get some efficiencies in their camp. And that's how it started. So, but then before I got to the U2 call, I got another person that influenced my life, was Roger Davies. Roger Davies then called me up and wanted me to go out and do the Tina 24/7 tour, Tina Turner.
Uh-huh.
And that to me was pretty special, you know, an icon.
Yeah.
And so, you know, all the way along, you've had these people that's been important to your career. So I did Tina, had a great time, love it. What a professional, what an artist. We had a great time. And, you know, then you strike up a friendship with someone like Roger Davis, which still exists to this day.
Yeah.
And then I go to Dublin and I sit in a room, and it's like another Rolling Stones. And if you walk in a room and the four guys are you too coming, like, you know, Bono is an icon. You go, Bono, with what he did, he's like, you know, he's other things he does. But the rest of the band was so nice, and they played their first single off that album, which was Beautiful Day.
Uh-huh.
And they said, we're going to tour. And then we sat down, I talked to each of them, and they said, we'd like you to come and help us on the tour. And the Rolling Stones were off. So I was happy. So I went along and worked alongside their production manager, Steve Iredale, which was a great when you say two production managers, it was tough, but it was good. We drew a line in the sand and we knew we liked each other. We were friends.
Yeah.
We drew a line in the sand so we knew what each other was doing.
Yeah.
So that was good.
Yeah. And you're still doing it with two bass techs.
There you go. Well, we have two of everything because, you know.
I've asked people about you, but you've never been shy. You've always been one to constantly bring people up in this industry. In an industry where people are protecting their gig and they don't want to help anyone out. Is that something because of how fortunate you were in the gig, the help that you got, and that you tend to look for help? You know, you're not looking for the next big guy. You're looking for the guy you can bring up.
You know, all of us who do this and all of us who probably speak on your podcast and all of yourself, I mean, this injury has been sensational to us. The injury is sensational. The industry in our industry is amazing. It's one of a kind. And you can't let it die. Yeah. And, you know, you can't. So you have to look for people that's going to take over from us, you know, whether that's male, female, gay, Asian, whatever. You got to find the right person to do the right job at the right time.
Yeah.
So you always look and there's. I remember the first person I looked at, I'm going, you're going to be good. I didn't realize how good, but I know he's going to be good, which was Del Shurseth, a.k.a. Opie.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I gave him his first gig, and I think it was Tesla and Great White. But you knew he was going to be good. Like I said, I didn't know how good. I mean, he's turned out to be amazing.
Yeah.
You know, truly top-notch and one of the best production managers around today.
Yeah.
So, and then you look, you know, the other thing, like, you know, you're only as good as your team. So if I don't have a good carpentry team or a good rigging team or a good lead truck driver or a good lead bus driver, I could look like shit. So I try to pick the people who's going to make me look good.
Right on.
And I've had some fortunate times with people. And, you know, I'd hear Florrie was my head carpenter. I think I was one of the first people to ever have a female head carpenter. So, I mean, that was important to me because the female aspect were always considered to be wardrobe or production coordinators. You know, that's how it started off. You couldn't be a sound girl. You couldn't be a lighting girl. You couldn't be
a TM.
Yeah, whatever. So
yeah,
that's come a long way, you know. But I think it's essential to bring up people.
Yeah. Have you had misses where you think, hey, they're going to be good and they just...
Yeah.
Yeah. Has been not as many as successes or...
No, because I've been very picky.
Uh-huh.
You know, I could probably name the people like Dale for sure. Ian Kinnersley's one that came up with me. We met. He was the third carpenter on a Metallica tour, and now he's a production manager in right. I mean, out here with our stage manager, John Boss. John Boss is going to be great.
Yeah.
John Boss needs to learn. He's got the people skills. He's got the presence. He's got the calm. He just needs to know how to deal with, you know, unions, how to deal a little bit more one-on-one with band, but he's got it.
Yeah.
He'll make
great
it.
Great stage manager.
Yeah.
And I really admire that about you. I've noticed that about you. Like you, the crew that I meet here, they'll say, I ask them, well, how long have you been here? And they'll say, well, this is my first tour and I've been here 8 years. You know, it's an organization that likes to give people opportunity.
Yeah.
And I really admire that because a lot of them, they don't. They'll say, well, you don't have experience. You can't work for us. But how are you going to get experience if you can't, not given the opportunity?
Like, somebody would always ask me that question. And my answer is, we all did our first gig sometime.
Yeah.
And if we don't do the first gig, we can't do the second.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the first gig, what do you do? I haven't done this before. If you got two hands, you got two legs, yeah, go and push that case to the truck.
Yeah.
And you know, on especially, you know, local help on big tours, you need so many. You're always going to have new people.
Yeah.
And I used to say to the union steward, give them to me. I'll push cases with them and I'll show them. You teach them, you know, this may sound cranky or corny, but you teach them, stage left, stage right, down, stage left, up, stage right, down, stage center. That's your first. I mean, now it's a bloody health and safety meeting. But back then, it was an orientation. And then you can pick out the good ones. And then when you come to say, I want a couple more guys on lights, you kind of know the guys that take it in.
Yeah.
And it can move up, and kind of the guys that will push boxes for the rest of their life because it's just a job and they don't have that enthusiasm.
Yeah. You ever had a nightmare gig that just nothing went right for you, where you questioned why you were even there?
Look, I'm sure I have. maybe I don't want to remember it. Maybe my mind is going
to
blank.
We tend to block those out.
Yeah.
What do you think you would have been doing if the
two cross, worlds collided?
If the two worlds collided, what would you be doing now?
I'd be probably living in Devon in a village like my brother. My brother's married and kids and got a successful business and a great relationship. I'm a nomad that. It's had two failed marriages, and I don't know, probably sitting in a pub with my corner store with my name on it because I've been going there for 50 years.
Right on. So, are you still, does this business still excite you?
Yeah.
It does?
I always said to myself when I stopped enjoying it, then I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And so far, you know, you get days where you go, what the hell am I doing? But by and large, it's still fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, here with you too at the residency, where we're not moving around all the time, I found the whole sphere thing very exhilarating.
Yeah.
To think, you know, what we've achieved and what we've done as a team. And I mean the U2 team, I mean the creative team, the audio team, the lighting team, but not only that, the sphere team and you know, the Postcards movie team.
Yeah.
I mean, we were here in... you know, August to September, and all we did in those months was to put together a U2, look, a phenomenal U2 show.
Yeah.
And if you've missed the Sphere, you've missed one of the shows of ever, the best show ever, show of the century, you know, and last century and this century. And, you know, all we did was put together a very complicated U2 show, which looks very simple when you sit in a crowd.
Yeah.
So that means if it looks simple, then that's what it was meant to be.
Yeah.
But nobody knows how complicated it is behind the scenes to get the video and the sound and everything lined up and to get it right. So, but putting that together along with opening in a venue, I mean, we were there were no seats on the floor. So we had to commission the seats. And then while we're doing that, you know, they're trying to put their Postcards from Earth movie out at the same time. So we were all battling for the same space.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, in the end, we worked 24 hours. There was 24-hour shifts. We never took the graveyard shift, by the way. That was down to construction. Because they were behind, so it was their fault they were there, not ours. That was the Sphere and my thought. And they were good people to work with.
Yeah.
And we'd come in at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the building guy, Jake, we need a couple of hours.
Yeah.
You go, okay. And we work around you, and that's the way this whole show, because the Sphere... You know, first of all, you've got to take your hats off to Mr. Dolan for putting up the kind of money to create what I consider now probably one of the most incredible venues in the world.
It is.
You know, and totally over budget, going way out of line, but no skimping on the inside. The inside is, you know, top notch all the way through. So, you know, and then it was... September the 29th, which was the opening of the U2 show, was a massive day. If everything had failed, we didn't want what I was calling Adele 2. You know, and she canceled the shows here because the show wasn't right. We didn't want Adele 2. That would have been the end of the Sphere, and it had set U2 back years, I think. So September the 9th, you know, the building opened, the band were ready. Towards the nice as possible way, U2 are never ready because they've always got to tweak.
Yeah.
There's always just that little bit more they think they can make it better, which is what makes them so successful.
Yeah.
So, you know, at 6 o'clock on the 29th, the first real test, can they get people into the building? And they did. And we started on time. The band played incredible for the first show. All the guest services and everything in the Sphere worked great. So it was a monumental opening. And the press around the world was like incredible.
Yeah.
But it so easily could have been the other way.
Yeah. I know I came in that last week of rehearsals and I remember asking someone, like, they must be getting like the clutch time for this last week. And they, because of all the work they were putting in, the band and the crew, of course, but the band. And they said they've been doing this for weeks. Like, they've been putting in this much. And to me, I had never seen a band work that hard. And it was very...
Well, I mean, it was huge for you.
It was huge.
For one or two reasons. Like, Larry, you know, having surgery and not being able to play and playing their first shows without Larry and having Bram come in and stand as drummer, that was huge.
Yeah.
The decision to play was huge, which was agreed by all four of them.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, we're going to do it. So, but Larry said he couldn't play in 23 and he wasn't fit to play.
Yeah.
He probably fit to play one show, but to go for a master front, I think he understood the enormity of it and was very honest about it.
Yeah.
So that was huge. The reaction from the crowd was going to be huge, you know, and if it hadn't worked out, then I think the Sphere could be gathering dust.
Yeah.
And instead of playing 40 shows like we're going to do next week and get out, we'd have done 12 and done.
Yeah.
And then there would have been nobody in there. And it would have relied on the Postcards from Earth film, which is, by the way, excellent.
Yeah. If you haven't seen that.
Yeah. Here's a big plug. Go to Vegas, see Postcards.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Dolan, that's 10%, please.
I remember being here in 2019 and they were still doing construction on it and being in one of these rooms that face it.
Yeah.
And thinking like, wow, I wonder what that's going to look like on the inside, and just were whispers of what it was going to look like. And to be given the opportunity to open it up is probably one of the... A big thing in my life.
You know, it was big. So,
yeah.
I mean, the opening night has definitely contributed to the success of, you know, where we are, the 40 nights. I mean, originally we were going to do 12. And then we go, 12 nights. And then it was 18, and then 24, and then 36. And then somebody goes, let's just round it off to 40. So that's how we got to. But 40 will be it, I think.
Right on. Well, do you hope to ever come back and do more shows here?
I'd love to. I really enjoyed it. I mean, this will always be the highlight, you know, the sense of achievement to get a show from basically a semi-construction site in working conditions to get to where we opened on the 29th of September was huge. You know, now it's down to everybody.
Yeah.
That was once again down to teamwork all across the board.
All right, on. Well, they did set the bar very high for anyone coming in.
It's scary how high the bar is, isn't it?
I know, right?
I mean, it's scary when you go in and you have people that don't like YouTube music walk out going, this is the best show I've ever seen.
Exactly.
That's, you know, first of all, they wouldn't have come.
Yeah.
If it had been an arena show, they wouldn't have come.
But because of the significance of the venue.
Well, it's a destination city. It's a must-see venue. You want to be there. It's got so much going for it, but you have to go back. It could have had so much going against it if September the 29th hadn't been successful.
Exactly. 100%. Yep. Well, Jake, I appreciate your time. It's been an honor working with you. And like I said, becoming your friend.
Doing a podcast in my kitchen here is something like that. That's amazing, right? Guys, you should see the backdrop. It's not very glamorous.
No, nothing like this.
I haven't cleaned the kitchen table yet, so all the crumbs are out.
It was a lifetime supply of Pellegrino.
You know, when you don't drink, you got one vice, and Pellegrino's my vice.
Right on. One more question. Thank you for doing this. Our podcast is called Is Breakfast Included? If we were having breakfast, Jake, what would you have?
I'd have a couple of fried eggs. Fried eggs. I like it. I live on eggs. Eggs, omelet, I don't care. Maybe a sausage, bit of English muffin.
Right on.
And then a Pellegrino, because I don't drink coffee or anything like that. So that's what I'd be doing. Oh. And if I was really lazy, I'd be having cornflakes, but I wouldn't be having cornflakes because I don't have any in the fridge. So I'm too lazy to go out and get something. So
and it's almost time to go home.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're running scrap. I'm running on scraps in my room right now.
I'm sure everybody's running on scraps. I mean, you know, the last thing we got, you know, we're really not used to being somewhere for 7 months. I mean, all you guys got to figure out, remember how you cabled it up and how you got to get it down with me screaming, to fucking hurry up, you know?
Yeah. So. I made a joke to Stuart the other day. I said, you know, when Jake called me, he's like, just come in, do this gig. It's
no load in, no load out. So I'm going to have to remind him of that on March 2nd. No loadout was part of my deal.
Oh, you can go home on Friday then.
Anyway, thank you for your time. It's
my
been
pleasure.
An honor getting to know you and doing this with you. And thank you for that phone call. But
I'm glad you picked up.
It's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you too, Brian. Thank you.
Right on, Mr. Jake Berry. I got to say this, and the residency is now over, but it was an honor working with that cat. The entire crew, the people I met on that crew were just all amazing. And it was definitely an experience for me, one that I won't soon forget. Check out our website, isbreakfast.com. Check out our Instagram, our YouTube channel. Go check it out, man. You can see these people in the flesh sometimes. Go to our store, buy a shirt. We're hopefully going to be adding some more products to that. We are in talks. Lisa and I are having just clutch cargo meetings about this every other day. All right, guys, I'm done. Have a great day. We'll talk to you next week.